For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and in today's show, a gripping, darkly comic tale of searing loss, coercive control, and the consequences of taking the wrong path, as we talk to author Charlotte Levin about her book, If I Let You Go. Plus, we'll find four brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. All that to come on today's Read On. Author Charlotte Levin was last on Read On in 2020 with her debut novel, If I Can't Have You, published at the height of lockdown. Her second novel, If I Let You Go, was published back in March of this year and will be published in paperback in a few weeks' time. Charlotte will join me in a moment to talk about the book, but let's hear from the audio version as read by actress Maxine Peake.
Three sheets of paper lie side by side. Edges must be neat, lined up. The contrast between the off-white and the black mock granite of the worktop exposes any misalignment. She's owned the stationery for years, a present from yet another drifted friend, never retrieved from the cupboard, never having noticed the delicate gold finches printed in the right-hand corner, one perched on a branch, the other flying away. The pen is heavy and cold, initially nervous about him finding out that she's used it. Her brain catches up. Of course, it doesn't matter now. These notes need to represent her properly, and nice ink is important. She'd hate to be remembered by the scrawls of a worn-out biro. Shuffling further back into the tall stool, she blinks, slow, heavy, and proceeds to write. Though all three notes differ in their content, each one opens with the same words. I am sorry.
It's about a woman called Janet Brown, and she's a kind of every woman, really. She's a cleaner from Salford, which is where I'm from. She's married to Colin, who is not the nicest person to her, and they're both grieving the loss of their daughter some years ago. And when Janet finds herself involved in a train accident, she takes an opportunity to make amends in some way for what has happened in the past. It's quite hard to discuss without giving things away.
It's a novel really about grief and redemption as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely. It's very much a sort of character-driven novel and about sort of moral dilemmas. Like my first book, I'm quite fascinated with the idea of good people kind of crossing boundaries and them still being kind of sympathetic characters.
So where did Janet actually come from?
Well, I had the idea for the concept of the novel, which involves things I can't talk about. And then I kind of worked backwards, which is what I do. It's like, who would that happen to and why? Why would someone do that? And sort of allow the reader to have an understanding of how they would do that. And even though the reader might not agree with behaviours, to kind of have an understanding. So I worked back and kind of got the character of Janet going backwards from that concept, really. The physicality and everything of Janet, the sort of character of Janet, came from when my mom was in hospital having an operation for her cancer. My aunt and I were cleaning her house to make it all nice for her return, and we were messing about, and my aunt tried on — we're both dark haired, my aunt and myself, my mom was always blonde — and we tried on her chemo wig and jumper that she had on, and my aunt looked so different that we were sort of laughing, and we gave this new person that she'd become the name Janet. And then fast forward years later, when I had the idea for If I Let You Go, the two kind of connected, and I thought, oh, that's who this character will be, that Janet. So it's almost like the seed had been planted many years prior for the actual character, even though I didn't have a story for her until that moment.
I thought that was going to go in a different direction there, actually, when you talked about cleaning, because Janet
Oh,
herself finds cleaning quite calming.
yeah, I forgot about that connection actually. Yeah, Janet's very not like me. She likes cleaning. And she's good at it. Yeah, I think she finds some kind of it's that feeling of control that she has some control in an environment where she is ultimately controlled and doesn't really have much control over her life.
Now, loneliness was a theme in your first novel. Do you think Janet, even though she's got Colin and Nish, and do you think she's a bit lonely herself?
I do, very, very much so. I mean, I think it's hard for Janet because she's sort of unable to form proper relationships because she can't sort of be entirely honest with people. And I think Nish is somebody who she definitely would form an even closer bond with, but there's always that distance. So I do think she is lonely. And it's weird as a writer, you don't set out to write certain things, but there's obviously, I think subconsciously, there's themes and ideas that interest each individual author, and whatever the plot, whatever you're writing, they seem to come through the same kind of things.
Now, we won't talk much more about it because we will get definitely get into spoiler territory. But you were first on the show in 2020 with If I Can't Have You. How was it being published when we were in lockdown?
Well, it was really very strange because obviously, like when you're trying to get a book published and you're a writer, that whole journey is very long. You know, it was so exciting to happen. And then it was happening in the worst year, I think, ever to be a debut novelist. So, yeah, the whole thing was just not as it was supposed to be. But within that, other authors who were coming out in 2020, we set up a group, Polly Crosby did, another author, and we set up a group called the D20s. And that was just amazing because we were all in the same boat, which was a very weird boat that, you know, had never been experienced before. So we really bonded over that, and we're still, you know, a support group for each other now. So without that, goodness knows what it would have been like.
Now, If I Can't Have You, I remember you saying you spent years writing it. How was it writing If I Let You Go when you were on a deadline?
Yeah, well, it's a completely different process, which when you're trying to get your first novel published, you don't really think ahead that much. So it took over, well, it was sort of 10 years from the first time I started writing, but then I rewrote the whole thing. And it was a good 5 years writing If I Can't Have You. And then suddenly you've got like a year to write the next one. And that includes coming up with the story, you know, the idea and everything. So it was a completely different process. And it was quite a stressful one because for the second one, there's always that doubt that the first one was a fluke, and you wonder whether you can actually do it again, especially in the time constraints. But now, I mean, I'm sim going through a similar thing with book three, where, you know, all the doubts are coming in, but I have to just trust the process now, remind myself that I felt like this with book two, and it does come together in the end. But it is very different to writing your first book.
She's invisible. A living ghost riding the number 73 bus through the streets of Salford. Crisp cotton blue top, light scrubs, ironed to perfection, the XL label cut out, and not just because it itched. All humanised by the name badge Janet. And, as always, a memorial to lost inner spark. Sparkly earrings, half moons bought by Colin many half moons ago. The fierce sun is a welcome break from the days of perpetual rain, and she rests her overheated head against the cool of the window to watch the daily rushes. Summer sky poking between penthouse-topped high-rises and poverty-stricken high-rises and red-brick daisy-chain houses as she nears home. All accented with colourful litter, pecked at by grey, hobbled pigeons.
And the title, If I Let You Go, could refer to a lot of things. Was that deliberate, or does it actually have a meaning for you?
Not really. I mean, I didn't pick my titles for either, to be absolutely honest with you. I think they wanted to keep it in line with my debut novel. So we went through literally hundreds of titles, but because If I Let You Go does have sort of layered meanings that could be applied to the plot, that's what they decided to go with. And it can be interpreted in a number of ways, really, in terms of the plot.
Now we've had Samuel Stevens and now we've got Colin. Charlotte, what have you got against men?
I'm so sorry. Do you know what? I'm writing my third book. I've got a really, really nice man, and my writing, you're really struggling to write a nice man, aren't you? So yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Nothing, I promise you. But they're just quite fun to write, I think. Both Samuel and Colin were quite fun to write because they were both awful in different ways. I think Colin has some of the best lines in the book, even though he is the most awful. So I apologize. I apologize for my terrible men writing.
Now, onto the writing. Do you prefer writing, or do you prefer having written something?
Generally, having written, I hate first drafts. Like, they are my nemesis. I can't stand doing first drafts. I love editing. So once I've got something, I can happily just get lost for hours and hours and hours, you know, making it work, making it land, rejigging the structure. But the staring at the blank page to me is actual horror. I really dislike it. So in terms of that, in terms of first draft, having written, but in terms of editing, I love the process. So writing, so a bit of both.
Now, you know one of those words that you've never heard before, and then you start hearing that again and again and again. I'm going to ask you this question. What is a pantser?
Oh, right. Well, I'm a pantser. So a pantser, I mean, it comes from the
The seat
seat
of
of
your
your
pants, I
pants.
think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm a pantser. Well, I'm a bit of both, actually, because I have like plot points that I've got an idea of, but I just cannot plan. Like, I've tried to plan and it absolutely does not work for me, because I think because I write such character-led novels, it's almost like they start dictating what's going to happen themselves. So for me to plan is just pointless. I kind of wish I could plan, because I think it must be so nice to actually sit down and write with a plan. So I can kind of see a couple of chapters ahead and that's it. So it's like, I think, I can't remember who said it, but they said writing a book's like driving in the fog, and you can literally just see that little bit ahead of you, and that's it. And that's what it's like for me.
Your characters ever surprise you?
Oh, all the time. Like, I have ideas where like a certain scene, or they're going to do something that's definitely going to happen, and then when it comes to that point, it's like, well, they just would not do that. You know, it's like they've become their own people now, and they would not behave in this way. So you have to be true to the characters, otherwise that's not nice for readers, because I think there's nothing worse than reading a book and you think that, you know, would they do that? I'm not sure they would do that. So I think that's really important. And often you have to just forget about ideas that you've had, because the characters just would not do that by the time you got to it.
Sitting up straight, she digs into her bag and removes one of the mini Bakewells brought in by Sam for Gemma's last day. She'd already eaten one with her post-shift tea, but couldn't resist the offer to take another home. Peeling the foil from its base, she presses the short pastry into her mouth. She likes Sam, despite being unable to get to know them properly. She likes all the Sam's cleaning angel girls, especially Nish. And she enjoys the hours ending her workday not long after the majority of people are about to start theirs. Few jobs offer such instant satisfaction, except perhaps a chocolatier. But even then, Coco loses its pleasure after a while. There's only so many Ferrero Rochers one can eat in a day. And she's good at it, cleaning. The other girls know not to touch her trolley. Compared to theirs, it is meticulous. Microfiber cloths stacked neatly when not in use, portions lined up, nozzles facing the same direction. The truth is, it calms her. Cleanliness, neatness. Dirt erased, surfaces shined, All the things we can't do with our souls can be achieved elsewhere with a damp cloth and some silly bang.
We've heard clips of the audiobook through the interview. Tell us what it was like getting Maxine Peake to read the book for you.
Well, I still can't believe she did it. It was just amazing. I mean, I've been a fan of Maxine for years. She lives quite near me, and I think she's an incredible actress. I was talking to my editor, and I wanted to get a book to her, and I don't really know why. I just felt like I wanted her to have the book, and we were just chatting, and I said, like, literally, it'd be a pipe dream to get her to read it. And then the next thing I know, they've asked her, and she agreed to do it. And I was in utter shock that that was happening. So I'm so lucky. I can't believe she did it. And I'm incredibly grateful to her. I didn't listen to my first book, but I had to listen to this one because I couldn't not if Maxine Peake was doing it. And she did an incredible job.
You've got an acting past. Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
It's really weird you say that, actually, because only last night I was listening to a book and I was thinking, I'd quite like to do my next one myself. I don't know whether I'd be able to do it or whether they'd let me and whether I'd be rubbish, but I would quite like to do one, yeah.
When we last spoke, you were already a few chapters into If I Let You Go. Are you already a few chapters into book three?
I have just today, just before I came on to chat to you, reached my midpoint of book three. So it's speeding up. The process is speeding up. But I mean, I write so many words before I get into a story, and I have so many false starts. So the beginning can take forever. And then once you're in it, it kind of does speed up. So I'm very glad. I'm going to celebrate this weekend that I've reached my midpoint.
Can you tell us anything about it?
Yeah, it's about an agoraphobic woman. I do suffer with agoraphobia, and she falls in love with her postman. But it's not really a romance as such. It's sort of about mental health and grief again, and lots of the other themes that have come forth in my other books. So it's quite different. My second one was different to my first one. And my third one's different to both my first and second. So that's not what you're supposed to do, but somehow that's what's happening.
So the last time you were on the show, you gave us the books of your life. But I believe since then, you're blaming me for turning you into a bit of an addict.
I am. I do blame you, Robert, because I buy so many audiobooks as well. I mean, I have Audible, but I spend so much money in the sales as well because I am now an addict of audiobooks. I never listened to one before. I never thought I would like it, being honest with you, because I thought I wouldn't be able to concentrate on it. And then when I was on the show last time, I thought I should listen to one and experience it. And I listened to Daisy Jones and the Six, which I still think is one of my favourite audiobooks that I've ever listened to. But it just opened up a whole world for me, and I absolutely love it. I find it so relaxing. I can't do anything. I couldn't possibly like make my dinner without having an audiobook in my ear. So I both thank you and blame you for introducing me to audiobooks.
Well, in lieu of books of your life, but I'll probably play the one you did last time at the end of the show, but give us a couple of recent listens.
Recent ones that I've listened to that I've liked, like a very recent release, is Yellow Face by R.F. Wong, which is about the publishing industry. It's about an author who steals the book of another author who has died. And if you're in publishing or have a particular interest in books, it basically a satire on the publishing industry. So for me, it was really funny and interesting. So I recommend that one.
After I'd queried nearly 50 literary agents without luck, the book was picked up by a small press named Evermore during an open call for submissions. The advance seemed like an absurd amount of money to me at the time, $10,000 up front, with royalties to come once I'd earned out. But that was before I learned Athena had gotten six figures for her debut novel at Penguin Random House. Evermore folded 3 months before my book went to print. My rights reverted back to me. Miraculously, my literary agent, who had signed me after Evermore's initial offer, resold the rights to one of the big five publishing houses for a $20,000 advance. A nice deal, read the publisher's marketplace announcement. It seemed like I had finally made it, that all my dreams of fame and success were about to come true. Until my launch day drew closer, and my first print run was reduced from 10,000 to 5,000 copies. My six-city book tour was reduced to three stops in the DMV area, and the promised quotes from famous writers failed to materialize. I never got a second printing. I sold 2,000, maybe 3,000 copies total. My editor was fired during one of those publishing squeezes that happen every time the economy dips, and I got passed along to some guy named Garrett, who has so far shown so little interest in supporting the novel that I often wonder whether he's forgotten about me entirely.
Yellowface by Rebecca F. Kwang is narrated by Helen Laser and is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books.
My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Tessa Moshfegh is another one I've recently listened to, which is a bit of a Marmite book, I think, but I really loved it. And again, I think it was really good for an audiobook because it's not much happens. And I can't really tell you what does happen. It's quite plotless, really. But the voice of the narrator, who some people don't like, but I found her very entertaining. So again, that was perfect as an audiobook.
The men who worked at the bodega were all young Egyptians. Besides my psychiatrist, Dr. Tuttle, my friend Riva, and the doorman at my building, the Egyptians were the only people I saw on a regular basis. They were relatively handsome, a few of them more than the others. They had square jaws and manly foreheads, bold, caterpillary eyebrows, and they all looked like they had eyeliner on. There must have been half a dozen of them, brothers or cousins, I assumed. Their style deterred me. They wore soccer jerseys and leather racing jackets and gold chains with crosses and played Z100 on the radio. They had absolutely no sense of humor. When I'd first moved to the neighborhood, they'd been flirty, even annoyingly so. But once I'd begun shuffling in with eye boogers and scum at the corners of my mouth at odd hours, they quit trying to win my affection. "You have something," the man behind the counter said one morning, gesturing to his chin with long brown fingers. I just waved my hand. There was toothpaste crusted all over my face, I discovered later. After a few months of sloppy, half-asleep patronage, the Egyptian started calling me boss and readily accepted my 50 cents when I asked for a Lucy, which I did often. I could have gone to any number of places for coffee, but I liked the bodega. It was close, and the coffee was consistently bad, and I didn't have to confront anyone ordering a brioche bun or no-foam latte. No children with runny noses or Swedish au pairs. No sterilized professionals. No people on dates. The bodega coffee was working-class coffee. Coffee for doormen and delivery men and handymen and busboys and housekeepers. The air in there was heavy with the perfume of cheap cleaning detergents and mildew. I could rely on the clouded freezer full of ice cream and popsicles and plastic cups of ice. The clear plexiglass compartments above the counter were filled with gum and candy. Nothing ever changed. Cigarettes in neat rows, rolls of scratch tickets, 12 different brands of bottled water, beer, sandwich bread, a case of meats and cheeses nobody ever bought, a tray of stale Portuguese rolls, a basket of plastic-wrapped fruit, a whole wall of magazines that I avoided. I didn't want to read more than newspaper headlines. I steered clear of anything that might pique my intellect or make me envious or anxious. I kept my head down.
My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh is narrated by Julia Whelan and is available commercially.
And I've listened to for the first time like a few months ago. I'd never read any Marianne Keyes, and she was so lovely about If I Can't Have You, and I thought I must read Marianne Keyes. And I listened to Rachel's Holiday, which she narrates herself, and it's now one of my favourite books. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I didn't think I'd enjoy it, but I absolutely loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
I knew I had to get up for work the following morning, so I took a couple of sleeping tablets. After about 10 minutes, they hadn't worked, so I took a couple more. And still my head was buzzing, So in desperation, thinking of how badly I needed my sleep, thinking of how alert I had to be at work, I took another two or three. I eventually got to sleep. A lovely, deep sleep. So lovely and deep that when the morning came and my alarm clock went off, I neglected to wake up. Bridget, my flatmate, knocked on my door, then came into my room and shouted at me, then shook me, then, at her wit's end, slapped me. I didn't really buy the wit's end bit. She must have known that slapping wouldn't wake me, but no one is in good form on a Monday morning. Then Bridget stumbled across a piece of paper that I'd been attempting to write on just before I fell asleep. It was just the usual maudlin, mawkish, self-indulgent poetry-style rubbish I often wrote when I was under the influence. Stuff that seemed really profound at the time, but that caused me to blush with shame when I read it in the cold light of day. The bits that I could read, that is. The poem went something like, "Mumble, mumble, life," something indecipherable, "bowl of cherries, mumble, all I get is the pits." Then, and I vaguely remembered writing this bit, I thought of a really good title for a poem about a shoplifter who had suddenly discovered her conscience. It was called "I Can't Take Any More." But Bridget, who'd recently gone all weird and uptight, didn't treat it as the load of cringe-making rubbish it so clearly was. Instead, when she saw the empty jar of sleeping tablets rolling around in my pillow, she decided it was a suicide note. And before I knew it, and it really was before I knew it because I was still asleep, well, asleep or unconscious, depending on whose version of the story you believe, she had rung for an ambulance, and I was in Mount Solomon having my stomach pumped. That was unpleasant enough, but there was worse to come.
To find the version of Rachel's Holiday, written and narrated by Marianne Keyes, you need to look out for the 25th anniversary edition. The version of Rachel's Holiday in the RNIB Talking Books Library is narrated by Marie McCarthy. If I Let You Go by Charlotte Levin is out now in hardback, audiobook and ebook, and I believe the paperback is imminent.
Yep, it's out on the 14th of September.
And Charlotte, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Robert. Thanks so much.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB Helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
Now on Read On, here's Lynn Livingston with some brand new RNIB Talking Books.
First this week, we have the hot new title, Penance, by Eliza Clark. It was donated to us by Faber and Faber.
Do you know what happened to her already? Did you catch it in the papers? Are you local? Did you know her? Did you see it on the internet? Did some website that trawls local news for the worst details of true crimes bring her to your attention? Did you see the article about her, buried in the chum box of an already disreputable website? Did you see the red-headed stock image model juxtaposed against an edited charred corpse captioned, "You won't believe what they did to her"? Did you listen to a podcast? Did the hosts make jokes? Do you have a dark sense of humor? Did that make it okay? Or were they sensitive about it? Did they coo in the right places? Did they give you a content warning? Did you skip ahead? Did you see pictures? Did you look for them? The crime took place in Joan's hometown of Crow-on-Sea in North Yorkshire. The seaside town sits between Scarborough and Whitby, protruding from the east coast of England like a small finger reaching for the continent. It has a beach to the north and a beach to the south. The north beach is loud. Brightly coloured amusement arcades, donkey rides, gift shops, and a small fun fair mean it is favoured by tourists and families. The south beach is classier. You'll find nice restaurants and little artisan shops overlooked by the ruins of Crow-on-Sea Castle. Both beaches are rimmed by rainbows of pretty pastel-coloured beach chalets. The North Beach chalets are council-owned and excessively priced. Most families in Crow could afford to rent a chalet on the North Beach, at least as a treat. The South Beach chalets are modern, privately owned, and pricey. Joan died on the South Beach.
It's been years since the horrifying murder of 16-year-old Joan Wilson rocked Crow-on-Sea, and the events of that terrible night are now being published for the first time. That story is Penance, a dizzying feat of masterful storytelling where Eliza Clark manoeuvres us through accounts from the inhabitants of this small seaside town.
During 2015 and 2016, both the northern and southern chalets had been the targets of a spate of arsons, and as a result, the few witnesses who saw the smoke did not inform the authorities. It was a tiny fire, and Crow's emergency services had dubbed the chalet burnings a waste of their time in a 2015 local news report. A beach chalet on fire was nothing to bat an eye at. Neither was a car occupied by three teenage girls speeding around the empty streets at 4:30 in the morning. The kids in Crow were bored. Minor acts of teen delinquency were a fact of life. The assailants were dubbed Girls A, B, and C until their identities were leaked by the local newspaper. Girl C, the oldest, drove. Girl A sat in the front, and Girl B in the back. Their accounts of the mood in the car vary. They do not agree whose idea it was to hurt Joan, who started it on the night, or who among them set the fire. Girl A blames Girl C, and vice versa. Girl B had been waiting in the car. She had not laid a hand on Joan and spent the night walking back and forth from the beach to the car in a state of shock and confusion. She claimed she tried to encourage the other girls to stop their assault. The other girls do not agree on this. Girls A and C say the fire was Girl B's idea.
Penance by Eliza Clark has a multicast of narrators, including Anna Gilthorpe, Emily Goldie, Evie Hargreaves, George Waitman, Holly J. Bowes, and Salima Saxton. It runs for 11 hours and 6 minutes.
Bloomsbury have donated The Librarianist by award-winning novelist Patrick DeWitt.
The morning of the day Bob Comet first came to the Gamble Reed Senior Center, he awoke in his mint-colored house in Portland, Oregon, in a state of disappointment at the fact of a dream interrupted. He had again been dreaming of the Hotel Elba, a long-gone coastal location he'd visited at 11 years of age in the middle 1940s. Bob was not known for his recall, and it was an ongoing curiosity to him that he could maintain so vivid a sense of place after so many years had passed. More surprising still was the emotion that accompanied the visuals. This dream always flooded his brain with the chemical announcing the onset of profound romantic love, though he'd not known that experience during his time at the hotel. He lay in his bed now, lingering over the feeling of love as it ebbed away from him. Bob sat up and held his head at a tilt and looked at nothing. He was a retired librarian, 71 years of age, and not unhappy. His health was sound, and he spent his days reading, cooking, eating, tidying, and walking. The walks were often miles long, and he set out with no destination in mind, choosing his routes improvisationally and according to any potentially promising sound or visual taking place down any potentially promising street.
Bob Comet is a retired librarian passing his solitary days surrounded by books in a mint-colored house in Portland, Oregon. One morning on his daily walk, he encounters a confused elderly woman lost in a market and returns her to a senior center that is her home. Hoping to fill the void he's known since retiring, he begins volunteering at the center. Here, as a community of strange peers gathers round Bob, and following a happenstance brush with a painful complication from his past, the events of his life and the details of his character are revealed. Behind Bob Comet's straight man's facade is the story of an unhappy child's runaway adventure during the last days of the Second World War, of true love won and stolen away, of the purpose and pride found in the librarian's vocation, and the pleasures of a life lived to the side of the masses.
Once he'd witnessed an apartment fire downtown. The Hook and Ladder Brigade had saved a baby from an uppermost window, and the crowd on the sidewalk had cheered and cried. And this was highly exciting for Bob. Another time, in the southeast quadrant, he'd watched a deranged man determinedly ripping out the flower beds in front of a veterinarian's clinic, while dogs looked on from the windows, craning their necks, and barking their sense of offense. Most days there was not so much to report or look upon, but it was always good to be in motion, and good to be out among the population, even if he only rarely interacted with any one person. He had no friends, per se. His phone did not ring, and he had no family. And if there was a knock on the door, it was a solicitor. But this absence didn't bother him, and he felt no craving for company. Bob had long given up on the notion of knowing anyone, or of being known. He communicated with the world partly by walking through it, but mainly by reading about it. Bob had read novels exclusively and dedicatedly from childhood and through to the present. On this day, Bob was fed and out the door before 9 o'clock in the morning. He had dressed according to the weatherman's prediction, but the weatherman was off, and so Bob had gone into the world unprepared for the cold and wet. He enjoyed being outdoors in poor weather, but only if he was properly outfitted. In particular, he disliked having cold hands, which he did have now. And so he entered a 7-Eleven, pouring himself a cup of coffee and lingering by the newspaper rack, warming himself while gleaning what news he could by the headlines. The cashier was a boy of 20, friendly but distracted by a woman standing at the rear of the store, facing a bank of glass doors which gave way to the refrigerated beverages. She wore a matching pink sweatsuit, bright white sneakers, a meshback baseball hat, and a pair of dark sunglasses. And she was standing still as statuary.
The Librarianist by Patrick DeWitt is read by Jim Meskimen and runs for 10 hours and 2 minutes.
Denise Miner has taken Raymond Chandler's famous character Philip Marlowe and written a new story featuring him. The Second Murderer was donated by Penguin Random House.
I was in my office, feet up, making use of a bottle of mood straightener I kept in the desk. A mid-September heat wave had descended on the city. Brittle heat rolled down from parched hills, lifting thin dust from roads and sidewalks, suspending it in the rising air and turning the sky yellow. Sounds became crisp and metallic. Everywhere people were gliding along through a gritty yellow fog, mean and squinting, spitting on sidewalks, waiting for the heat to break. I don't usually drink in the office at 10:30 in the morning, but I had a bad taste to wash away. The Pasco Pete case was solved, the murderer was arrested, and everyone else had moved on but me. I couldn't. There was something wrong, something bad in it, like a mouthful of soup with a stray hair that brushes your lip on the way in and then disappears. The facts rolled around in my head, tumbling over each other in a smaller circle every time. Something was wrong.
It's mid-September. A heat wave has descended on the parched hills of LA, and private detective Philip Marlowe is called to the Montgomery Estate, an almost mythic place sitting high on top of Beverly Hills. Wealthy 22-year-old Chrissy Montgomery, set to inherit an enormous fortune, is missing. She's a walking target, ripe for someone to get their claws into. Her dying father, along with his sultry, bottle-blonde girlfriend, wants her found before that happens. They've hired Anna Reardon, Marlowe's nemesis, too. The search takes them to the roughest neighbourhoods of LA through dive bars and Skid Row. And that's before he finds the body at the Brody Hotel. Who will get to her first? Marlowe, Anne, or the men chasing her fortune? And does she want to be found?
I'd narrowed it down to the sighting of Pasco Pete the day after he had been murdered. Pete was being driven by a busty blonde with a badly mended cleft lip in a jalopy, careening down Alameda, and they were both laughing so hard at a joke that they almost crashed. In a good lie, the victim would be spotted with a man in a hat, a brunette, or a tall man. They'd be seen with a generic person. Black Jack's mistake was in making it too specific. But the case was solved and closed, neat and tidy. No one was giving it a second thought but me, rolling it over and over in my head. It had started with the heat wave. I arrived at the office one morning and found Baby Maud waiting patiently, sitting on a wooden fold-down, upright in her whalebone stays with her purse perched on her knee. Maud was a 60-year-old child star. She wore a good-quality purple day suit that was faded and mended and carefully pressed. Her hatless hair was an unmoving, permanent wave dyed blackest black, but she hadn't had time for the beauty parlor recently. Her roots were so white and bright, they shone like stars in a black sky. Heavy face powder nestled in the wrinkles and folds of her face, except for the tracks of hastily dabbed away tears on each cheek. Maud had been weeping while she waited, and she didn't seem the type for it.
The Second Murder by Denise Mina is read by Scott Brick, and it lasts for 8 hours, 11 minutes.
Joanna Lee is a favourite of our readers. We have recently received The Villa, which was donated to us by Quercus.
Tess didn't open the letter until later, when she was sitting on the beach. In a hurry to get to work that morning, she'd barely glanced at the envelope, just grabbing it from the mat before kissing her daughter Ginny goodbye. Now, Tess plucked the letter from her bag, read her name, Ms. Teresa Angel, and her address, in bold, confident typescript, Frankton postmarked London. Ginny had left for college, an unruly streak of long legs, jeans, red shirt, dark hair and eyes, while Tess had set off for the water company, where she worked in customer information, a euphemism for complaints, since who really needed information about water? Turn on the tap, out it comes. Better still drink the bottle variety.
Set against the rugged coast of Sicily, The Villa is an epic journey of love lost, family secrets, the road to self-discovery, and the meaning of home and family. When Tess Angel receives a letter informing her she's inherited the Villa Sirena, perched on a clifftop in Sicily, she's stunned. Her only link to the small, beautiful island is through her mother, Flavia, who left Sicily during World War II and has not spoken to her family or of her life there since. Initially resistant to Tess travelling to her home country, Flavia begins to recount her youth, told in flashbacks, as she writes in a journal to Tess of her journey to independence, as well as leaving her legacy of cherished family recipes and secrets. Secrets, including a lost treasure rumoured to be hidden in the very villa Tess is staying at. Told in alternating points of view between Tess, Flavia, and Tess's teenage daughter Ginny, dealing with her blooming sexuality, and filled with questions that she longs to ask her long-absent father.
This was her lunch break, and she'd come, as she often did, to Pride Bay, 5 minutes away by car, to eat her sandwiches by the sea. It was an early spring day, and breezy, so she too was sandwiched between a row of pastel-painted beach huts and the high mound of tiny ginger pebbles of West Dorset's Chesil Beach. This gave Tess some shelter, and she could still just see the waves. She didn't have to be back in the office till 2:30. She stretched out her legs. Flexi time. What a wonderful invention. Tess eased her thumb under the seal of the envelope and tore it open, sliding out a single sheet of white paper. It was so thick and creamy, she almost felt she could eat it. Dear Ms. Angel, she read, we are writing to inform you. Her eyes scanned over the text. Following the sad passing of Edward Westerman. Edward Westerman? Tess frowned as she tried to make sense of it. Did she know an Edward Westerman? She was pretty sure she didn't. Did she even know anyone who had just died? Again, no. Could they have got the wrong Teresa Angel? Unlikely. She read on. Concerning the bequest. Bequest? On the condition that... Tess's mind raced. Hang on a minute. Sicily? Tess finished reading the letter, then immediately read it again. She felt a kind of nervous fluttering, like moth's wings, followed by a rush of pure adrenaline. It couldn't be true. Could it? She stared out at the sea. The breeze had picked up and was ruffling the waves into olive-grey rollers. She must be dreaming, she thought. She picked up the letter and read it through once more as she finished her sandwich. Well, what on earth would her mother say? Tess shook her head. There was no point thinking about it. It was a mistake, surely it had to be a mistake. It was clouding over now, and Tess felt chilly, despite the woolen wrap she had slung over her work jacket when she left the car by the harbour. She checked her watch. She should go. But if it were true, if this wasn't some sort of joke, then... Sicily! Tess tucked the letter back into her bag and began to put the jigsaw pieces together in her mind. Her fierce and diminutive mother, Flavia, was Sicilian, though she had left her home and her family when she was in her early 20s. Tess just wished she knew why. She had tried often enough to find out the full story, but Mamma had never wanted to talk of her life in Sicily. Tess smiled as she got to her feet and picked up her bag. She loved her dearly, but Mamma was stubborn, and Sicily was out of bounds.
The Villa by Rosanna Leigh is read by Anna Bentinck and runs for 15 hours and 48 minutes.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
And finally on today's show, from our first time on Read On, here's Charlotte Levin and the Books of Our Life. Charlotte, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, I think I mentioned to you before, because basically I never read as a child. I wasn't brought up in a sort of very booky family. Well, my granddad read loads, actually, that's not true, but my mum didn't, and so I never really read much. But as I got into a teen, I was very into acting, and I consumed plays, and I read them like books, and particularly one play called Road by Jim Cartwright I was completely obsessed with as a teenager. But in terms of books, the first book, and I haven't read it since, so I may not even like it now, was Catcher in the Rye My auntie gave it to me and I just was so engrossed in it. And I remember I was visiting her in London. I was about 18. I was reading it on the tube and walking with it, reading, and I was completely obsessed with it. So that's the first time I realised that you could actually be completely engrossed in a book, as opposed to plays and things which I'd been reading prior.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it. In the first place, that stuff bores me, and in the second place, my parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all, I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell. Besides, I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me around last Christmas before I got pretty run down and had to come out here and take it easy. I mean, that's all I told DB about, and he's my brother and all. He's in Hollywood. That isn't too far from this crummy place, and he comes over and visits me practically every weekend. He's going to drive me home when I go home next month, maybe. He's just got a Jaguar. One of those little English jobs that can do around 200 miles an hour. It cost them damn near $4,000.
The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger is available from RNIB Library and it's read by Marvin Kane.
Now, is there a book on a rainy day that you go back to and reread again and again?
I'm not a massive rereader, to be honest. But there is one book, I haven't read it again for years though. But in terms of like on a rainy day, when I have read it, I've just consumed it in a day and it's perfect. And that's Breakfast at Tiffany's by Truman Capote. I thought that I didn't need to read it ever because everyone knows the film, but I think it's so much better than the film. It's a bit grittier and it hasn't got that Hollywood ending. And it's really short. So it's perfect rainy day reading. If you just want to go from start to finish on something, that would be my recommendation for that.
I am always drawn back to places where I have lived, the houses and their neighbourhoods. For instance, there is a brownstone in the East 70s where during the early years of the war, I had my first New York apartment. It was one room crowded with attic furniture, a sofa and fat chairs upholstered in that itchy particular red velvet that one associates with hot days on a train. The walls were stucco and a color rather like tobacco spit. Everywhere, in the bathroom too, there were prints of Roman ruins freckled brown with age. The single window looked out on a fire escape. Even so, my spirits heightened whenever I felt in my pocket the key to this apartment. With all its gloom, it still was a place of my own, the first, and my books were there, and jars of pencils to sharpen, everything I needed, so I felt, to become the writer I wanted to be. It never occurred to me in those days to write about Holly-go-lightly, and probably it would not now except for a conversation I had with Jo Bell that set the whole memory of her in motion again. Holly-go-lightly had been a tenant in the old brownstone. She'd occupied the apartment below mine. As for Jo Bell, he ran a bar around the corner on Lexington Avenue. He still does. Both Holly and I used to go there 6-7 times a day, not for a drink, not always, but to make telephone calls. During the war, a private telephone was hard to come by. Moreover, Jo Bell was good about taking messages, which in Holly's case was no small favor, for she had a tremendous many.
Peter Whitman reading Breakfast at Tiffany's and Other Stories by Truman Capote, which is available in the RNIB library.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I will actually recommend the audiobook because, to be honest, I've really been in a reading slump since the lockdown and I've found it really hard to concentrate on things, and I have enjoyed some books, but this book gave me absolute joy from start to finish. I completely loved it. I thought it was fantastic and so unique and well done. I don't know, to be honest, if I can't imagine it working as well to be read, though people have corrected me on that, but it's just such a good audiobook. I highly recommend it. It's Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Daisy Jones was born in 1951 and grew up in the Hollywood Hills of Los Angeles, California. The daughter of Frank Jones, the well-known British painter, and Liane Lefebvre, a French model, Daisy started to make a name for herself in the late 60s as a young teenager on the Sunset Strip.
Elaine Chang, biographer, author of Daisy Jones, Wildflower. Here is what is so captivating about Daisy Jones, even before she was Daisy Jones. You've got a rich white girl growing up in L.A. She's gorgeous, even as a child. She has these stunning big blue eyes, dark cobalt blue. One of my favorite anecdotes about her is that in the 80s, a colored contact company actually created a shade called Daisy Blue. She's got copper red hair that is thick and wavy and takes up so much space. And then her cheekbones almost seem swollen. That's how defined they are. And she's got an incredible voice that she doesn't cultivate, never takes a lesson. She's born with all the money in the world, access to whatever she wants, artists, drugs, clubs, anything and everything at her disposal. But she has no one, no siblings, no extended family in Los Angeles, two parents who are so into their own world that they are all but indifferent to her existence. Although, they never shy away from making her pose for their artist friends.
Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is narrated by a full cast, including Jennifer Beals, Benjamin Bratt, Judy Greer, and Pablo Schreiber, and is available commercially. Charlotte Levin, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.